content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And we will start today with The New King of Tech. This is written by James Surowiecki. Another day, another new AI large language model that's supposedly better than all the previous ones. When I began writing this story, Elon Musk's XAI had just released Grok 3, which the company says performs better than its competitors against a wide range of benchmarks. As I was revising the article, Anthropic released Claude 3.7 Sonnet, which it says outperforms Grok 3. And by the time you read this, who knows? Maybe an entirely new LLM will have appeared. In January, after all, the AI world was temporarily rocked by the release of a low-cost, high-performance LLM from China called DeepSeek-R1. A month later, people were already wondering when DeepSeek R2 would come out. The competition among LLMs may be hard to keep track of, but for NVIDIA, a company that designs the computer chips or graphics processing units, otherwise known as GPUs, that many of these large language models have been trained on, it's also enormously lucrative. NVIDIA, which, as of this writing, is the third most valuable company in the world after Apple and Microsoft, was started three decades ago by engineers who wanted to make graphic cards for gamers. How it evolved into a company that is providing almost all the picks and shovels for the AI gold rush is a story at the core of Stephen Witt's The Thinking Machine. Framed as a biography of Jensen Huang, the only CEO NVIDIA has ever had, the book is also something more interesting and revealing, a window onto the intellectual, cultural, and economic ecosystem that has led to the emergence of super powerful AI. That ecosystem's center, of course, is Silicon Valley, where Huang has spent most of his adult life. He was born in Taiwan, the son of a chemical engineer and a teacher. The family moved to Thailand when he was five, and for a few years later, his parents sent him and his older brother to the United States to escape political unrest. Eventually, his parents relocated to the U.S. as well, and Huang grew up in the suburbs of Portland, Oregon. In early 1980s, after majoring in electrical engineering at Oregon State, which at the time didn't offer a computer science major, he got a job at Advanced Micro Devices, the company, then the poor cousin of the chip giant Intel, was headquartered in Sunnyvale, California, near US 101, the highway that runs from San Jose to Stanford. Since then, Huang's career has unfolded within a five-mile radius of that office. Huang soon left AMD for a firm called LSI Logic Corporation, which built software design tools for chip architects, then left LSI in 1993 to start NVIDIA with the chip designers Curtis Priam and Chris Malachowski. He was right on target to run something by the age of 30, as he'd told them he aimed to do. The company was entering a crowded marketplace for developing graphics cards, the computer hardware that's used to render images and videos. NVIDIA didn't have a real business plan, but Huang's boss at LSI recommended him to Sequoia Capital. One of the Valley's most important venture capital firms, Sequoia helped the company get off the ground. The graphics card business was built on a perpetual upgrade cycle that forced developers into a never-ending game of performance improvement. A company was only as good as its last card. At various points in those early years, NVIDIA was one misstep away from bankruptcy, and its unofficial motto became, "Our company is 30 days from going out of business." One gets the impression that Wong liked it that way. He said his heart rate goes down under pressure, and to call him a relentless worker is to underestimate matters. I should make sure that I'm sufficiently exhausted from working, that no one can keep me up at night, he once said. His reading diet features business books, which he devours. He has no obvious politics, or at least never discusses them. He's not a gaudy philanthropist. Though devoted to his family, he's also honest. Lori, he says of his wife, did 90% of the parenting of their two children. For the past 30 years, his life has clearly revolved around NVIDIA. Wong's reluctance to talk about himself makes him a challenging subject for Witt to bring to life. But NVIDIA's employees, who almost all refer to Wong by his first name, are effusive. They worship him. I believe they would follow him out the window of a skyscraper if he saw a market opportunity there, Witt writes. He later adds they see Wong not just as a leader, but as a prophet. Jensen was a prophet who made predictions about things. And then those things came true. He has a ferocious temper, referred to in the company as the Wrath of Wong, and is notorious for publicly reprimanding at length workers who have made mistakes or failed to deliver. But he rarely fires people, and in fact inspires intense devotion. One of his key subordinates says, "I've been afraid of Jensen sometimes, but I also know that he loves me." Wong's greatest strength as a CEO has been his willingness to make big, risky bets when opportunities present themselves. The first of these came when he changed the architecture of NVIDIA's chips from serial processing to parallel processing. Witt calls this move a radical gamble because up to that point, no company had been able to make selling parallel processing chips a viable business. Serial computing is the way your computer's central processing unit works. It executes one instruction at a time, very, very fast. Witt likens it to telling one delivery van to drop off packages in sequence. By contrast, NVIDIA's parallel GPU acts more like a fleet of motorcycles spreading out across a city, with the drivers delivering each package at roughly the same time. The coding required to make parallel processing work was much more complex, but if you could do it, you had access to enormous amounts of computing power. Initially, all that power was used mainly to make computer games look and perform better. But then Wong took another big risk, remaking NVIDIA's GPUs so they could also process massive data sets of the kind scientists might use. As one NVIDIA executive puts it, you have a video game card on one side, but it has a switch on it. So you flick that switch and turn the card over, and suddenly the card becomes a supercomputer. The fascinating thing about this decision was that Wong didn't know who might want to buy a supercomputer in the guise of a graphics card, or how many such people were out there. He was just betting that if you make powerful tools available to people, they will find a use for them, and at scale to justify the billions in investment. That use, and it was big, turned out to be artificial intelligence, in particular, neural network technology. As Witt notes, just as parallel processing was revolutionizing computing, a similar revolution was happening in AI research, though no one at NVIDIA was paying attention to it. AI had gone through a series of boom and bust cycles as researchers tried different techniques, all of which ultimately failed. One of those methods was neural networks, which tried to mimic the human brain and allow the AI to evolve new rules of learning on its own. When you train these networks on massive databases of images and text, they can, over time, identify patterns and become smarter. Neural networks had long been peripheral, partly because they're black boxes. You can't explain how the AI is learning or why it's doing what it's doing. and partly because the computing power required to make a high-performance neural network operate was out of reach. Parallel processing GPUs changed all that. Suddenly, AI researchers, if they could write software well enough to get the most out of the chips, had access to sufficient computing power to allow neural networks to evolve at an extraordinary pace. In 2009, Jeff Hinton, one of the godfathers of AI research, told a conference of machine learning experts to go buy NVIDIA cards. And in 2012, one of Hinton's students, Alex Krizhevsky, strung together two NVIDIA GPUs and built and trained SuperVision, which he later named AlexNet. It was an AI model that could, for a long time, identify images with startling accuracy, largely because, in Witt's words, the GPU produced in half a minute what would have taken an Intel machine an hour and would have taken biology 100,000 years. Wong did not immediately recognize the importance of what had happened. When he spoke at NVIDIA's annual GPU technology conference in 2013, he never mentioned neural networks, talking instead about weather modeling and computer graphics. But a few months later, after an NVIDIA researcher named Byron Catanzaro made a direct pitch to him about the importance of AI, Wong had what Witt calls a Damascene epiphany. He placed another big bet, essentially transforming NVIDIA from a graphics company into an AI company over the course of a weekend. This bet was less risky than his earlier ones because even though NVIDIA had competitors who also built GPUs, none of them had really designed theirs to be used as supercomputers. Still, going all in was prescient. Developments such as large language models had yet to take off, and this is what has turned NVIDIA into a nearly $3 trillion company. That weekend feels as if it were a compressed culmination of NVIDIA's story, which isn't empirically true. The 12 years that followed have been incredibly eventful and incredibly profitable as the company has kept improving its chips, servicing the insatiable appetite for computing power created by the emergence of large language models, and fending off competitors, many of whom are NVIDIA's customers, now building their own chips. But the foundations for that pivot and all that ensued were already in place when Wong decided to act on his AI insight. Those foundations, the thinking machine book title makes clear, were not laid by NVIDIA alone. Indeed, among Witt's key contributions is to show that NVIDIA's success can't be understood apart from the culture and economy of Silicon Valley and of tech more generally. Take the simple fact of free labor markets. One catalyst of the Valley's success, as the scholar Anna Lee Saxenian has famously argued, was a free-willing, risk-taking culture that encouraged workers to leave companies for competitors or to start their own firms. And that depended in part on the fact that non-compete clauses are unenforceable in California. And NVIDIA's history exemplifies this, not just Wong's mobility, but that of his early hires as well. Later, one of the company's favorite tactics was to poach its competitors' best engineers and coders. Bad form, perhaps, but a good business tactic. NVIDIA also benefited from the research investments made by the government and universities. One of the crucial breakthroughs in unlocking the power of parallel computing, for instance, was an open-source programming language called Brook, which a gamer and Stanford graduate student named Ian Buck developed with a group of researchers in 2003, relying on a Defense Department grant. Alex Krizhevsky and his partner, Ilya Sutskever, who later helped start OpenAI, were grad students at the University of Toronto when Krizhevsky devised AlexNet. The contest in which the model demonstrated its accuracy, the ImageNet Challenge, was designed by a Stanford computer scientist named Fei-Fei Li. And as that lineup demonstrates, Krizhevsky and Sutskever were born in the Soviet Union, Li in China. Immigration has been central on the history, if not just NVIDIA, but AI generally. Practical economic features of the ecosystem mattered as well. The most important was the rise of independent chip foundries, factories that serve many different companies and make chips on order. NVIDIA's partnership with Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, the best known of these factories, allowed it to become a dominant player by focusing on designing and writing software for its chips. NVIDIA didn't have to invest in actual production, which would have required prohibitive amounts of capital. Finally, NVIDIA benefited from patience and its board's willingness to put long-term thinking ahead of short-term profits. Because of the gaming market, NVIDIA was almost always a profitable company, but its stock price dropped nearly 90% two different times. It didn't fully appreciate for a full 10 years after the dot-com bubble burst, while the company was spending billions, turning its graphic cards into supercomputers. One familiar indictment of American capitalism is that it is too short-term focused. In the tech industry, at least, the trajectory of NVIDIA and many other companies suggest that's a bum rap. To be sure, Wang himself was central to NVIDIA's success. He has run the company essentially on his own. As Witt puts it, he has had no right-hand man or woman, no major domo, no second-in-command, and he's made the bold moves. What's more, he seems to have done so without a trace of doubt. Lots of people in the AI industry, including the people training LLMs, have raised concerns about AI's dangers, but Wang is not one of them. For him, Witt writes, AI is a pure force for progress. Wang does not fret that it may eat all of our jobs, or replace artists, or go rogue and decide to wipe out humanity. In fact, when Witt, stricken with existential anxiety about how AI will change the world, asks Wang whether some of these concerns might be worth pondering, he is subjected to one of his legendary tirades. Is it going to destroy jobs? Wang asked, his voice crescendoing with anger. Are calculators going to destroy math? That conversation is so old, and I'm so tired of it, he said. I don't want to talk about it anymore. We make the marginal cost of things zero, generation after generation after generation, and this exact conversation happens every single time. You could write off this as an example of Upton Sinclair's adage, it is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it. But the fact that Wang talks about AI in terms of its impact on marginal costs shouldn't be reduced to mere opportunism. It fits right in with the single-minded focus on performance that has driven him from NVIDIA's beginning. Witt at one point calls Wang a visionary inventor. The vision Wang has been in thrall to, though, seems to be less about grand future goals and more about tools, about making the fastest, most powerful chips as efficiently as possible. Existential risk has no place in that vision. Wang's unapologetic stance on AI is bracing in its way, especially in contrast with the public hand-wringing of so many AI chieftains fretting about the dangers of their LLMs while continuing to develop them. But he is, in effect, making the biggest, riskiest bet ever, not just for NVIDIA, but for all of us. Let's hope he's right. Today's second story, Quaker parents were ahead of their time. The nearly 375-year-old religion's principles line up surprisingly well with modern parenting research. This was written by Gail Cornwall. One morning in 1991, I prayed with the fervor that only a tween can muster for one thing above all others, cold diet Mountain Dew. But all of the cans in my mom's stash were warm. So I tossed one in the freezer, forgot about it, and hours later retrieved the frozen solid mass. Then I decided to pop it in the microwave. You can imagine what ensued. After extinguishing the flames, my mom asked us kids what we thought had happened. I stepped forward as if approaching the gallows, and she lavished me with praise for telling the truth, for taking responsibility. Her response might seem surprising, but we're Quakers, and avoiding judgment is pretty on brand. From where I stand now, I can see that her decision to use positive reinforcement aligns with research on motivating kids, something I've become quite familiar with as a journalist covering parenting and education. Still, for years, I didn't recognize the connection between my faith and the child development studies I frequently combed through at work. Then, when the coronavirus pandemic temporarily left our public school without enough adults to meet my son's needs, we switched him to a Quaker school. The school is organized around an acronym I'd never heard before, SPICES. That stands for principles I know well: simplicity, peace, integrity, community, equality, and stewardship. Those aren't the only pillars of Quakerism, but they're big ones, and seeing them all together got me thinking. Sitting in the meeting house one Sunday morning, after nearly an hour of silent worship, I had a Queen's Gambit moment. Whereas the chess champ saw pawns moving across a phantom board, I saw each child-rearing best practice I had been writing about line up with the principle of Quakerism. The Religious Society of Friends, Quaker being a derogatory term reclaimed, is a hard faith to explain because it tries to eschew dogma. It's not possible to be a Muslim Quaker or a Hindu one, or to not believe in any God at all. That said, Quakers all over the world tend to talk about the same principles and take part in some of the same practices. For example, in place of rules, Quakers publish advices and queries, which prompt individuals to make good, considered choices. Attendees of Quaker meetings near me were recently asked to ponder, "Do I make my home a place of friendliness, joy, and peace, where residents and visitors feel God's presence?" The children's version read, "In what ways am I kind to people in my home?" Certain expectations underlie these questions, that one should try to be kind, for example, but so do curiosity and an openness to differing answers. As it turns out, leading with questions is a great way for parents to talk to children. Encouraging kids to come up with their own solutions grants them autonomy. And as Emily Edlin, a psychologist and author of Autonomy Supportive Parenting, told me, kids who feel like they have control over their life experience better emotional health, including less depression and anxiety. Fostering kids' autonomy has also been tied to children building stronger self-regulation skills, doing better in school, and navigating social situations more effectively. Best of all, once kids get used to the self-discipline that comes with exercising autonomy, it can become habitual. Give your kids agency in one area, and they tend to develop internal motivation, even for things they do not want to do, Edlin said, because they're integrating the understanding of why those things are so important. It can be scary to trust children with independence, but kids are better problem solvers than some people might think. When my son at age 10 asked me if he could play laser tag with friends, I asked him how he could avoid pulling a trigger in deference to Quaker value of pacifism. He decided to serve as referee. I was proud of him for exercising discernment, another Quaker value, all on his own, for listening to his still small voice within and letting it guide him to a solution that satisfied his need for belonging. He is now 13 and recently couldn't decide whether to accept a babysitting job or relax at home. I asked him, "What do you think tomorrow you will wish today you had done?" He picked out stuffed animals to give his charges, spent the evening feeling needed, and had cash the next day when he wanted to buy a boba for a friend. Obviously, real damage could come from giving kids complete autonomy, and Quakerism recognizes this. Early Quaker epistles inveigh against permissiveness, and a 1939 text, Children and Quakerism, quotes William Penn, the Quaker who founded Pennsylvania, saying, "If God gives you children, love them with wisdom, correct them with affection." In other words, pacifism doesn't mean that parents can't set boundaries. In a 1967 book about Quaker education, Friends and Their Children put it, "It is a difference in principle between setting an army on the march and carrying a tired and hysterical child up to bed. So when my son used to leave toys out, I wouldn't clean up for him. I'd prompt him to do so. I see blocks still sitting on the floor. That was usually enough. When it wasn't, I would stage a mini sit-in, and we wouldn't go on with our evening until the blocks were put away. The type of consequence that's crucial for raising considerate kids. If he hollered, I would bear witness to his suffering and be with him, silent but unwavering." Perhaps the most important element of Quaker parenting is the edict to let your life speak. In practice, that looks like apologizing to your kids freely, saying please and thank you, and yes, trying not to shout at them. It means acting in accordance with your values, such as when my grandma took me to pack toothbrushes and soap into kits for Kosovo, and when my kids make PB&Js for our unhoused neighbors or bring games to a family shelter. The idea, supported by common sense and reams of research, is that kids develop empathy by living it alongside their caregivers. What's more, another study establishes that knowing that their parents value kindness above achievement protects kids' well-being. This is where Quaker parenting has stepped in for me, providing a simple way to separate the wheat from the child development chaff. It gives me plenty to cling to, but its guiding principles are also flexible enough to allow leeway. But in shortcomings lies the essential Quaker parenting lesson. We favor queries over strictures because of a concept known as continuing revelation, or the idea that we cannot know all there is to know, or we will always later realize we were wrong. This principle has helped me cultivate humility and compassion for myself after missteps. Quaker principles remind me not just about the value of autonomy, but also that kids need stillness and peace of mind, that pestering them isn't likely to lead to the nonviolent communications that improve connection, and that the goal is for teens to develop a purpose-based identity rather than a performance-based one. So I resist the urge to monitor and intervene, just as research on anxiety suggests I should. That article was edited for time constraints, as we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.